The last 2 weeks of impeachment hearings have given us all a very odd glimpse into the lives of civil servants, diplomats, and ambassadors, what they do and who they are, the personal motivations behind their service.
I expect that few Americans have heard my name before these events. So before I begin my substantive testimony, please let me share some of my personal background.
But before I do so, I'd like to communicate two things. First, I'd like to share a little bit about who I am. I'm an American by choice, having become a citizen in 2002.
By way of background, it has been a privilege for me to serve our country and the American people for more than 50 years, starting as a cadet at West Point, as you have mentioned, Mr. Chairman, then as an infantry officer for 6 years, including with the 101st Airborne Division in Vietnam, then at the Department of Energy, then as a member of a Senate staff, then at NATO, then with the State Department here and abroad.
I don't know about you, but I find these vignettes riveting, sometimes even inspiring, in the middle of this historic moment that is just totally disconcerting in almost every other way. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear from young Kansas Cityans who are just now beginning to think about a future in the Foreign Service. How has this all looked and sounded to them? Are they having second thoughts, or have the impeachment hearings bolstered their interest in diplomacy? Let's find out. My first guest is Mia Richardson. She's a KCK native and a recent college grad who's joined the Peace Corps. She'll be joining us this morning from Northern Macedonia. Hi, Mia.
Hi, Gina. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to have you. Tell me about Macedonia and what you're doing there in the Peace Corps.
So I'm teaching English at a primary school in a really small village, and I'm about a year into my service. It's been amazing so far, and I have about a year left to go.
So you want to be in the Foreign Service eventually, is that right?
Yes, that's the overall goal.
Can you trace the earliest beginnings of your interest in diplomacy? What inspired you to think about your own future in that way?
Yeah, I actually can. So I started doing debate when I was in middle school in KCK. And in high school, I did a research project about the Cold War. And I think those two things are kind of what came together to start shaping this idea for me, partly just because I realized I was so interested in the Cold War, but not just in general, very specifically in how the United States had formulated its foreign policy during that time.
How old were you when you were doing this report?
I was in high school, so I was maybe 16 when I started it.
Okay, and do you remember like the details that you read that were like, whoa, Cold War is super interesting?
Yes, but I don't know how many other people they will sound interesting to. My paper was about the use of nuclear weapons as a bargaining tool in the foreign policy between the United States and the Soviet Union. And so I started digging down into the details of the nuclear treaties that were negotiated during that time, and the START Treaty and the INF Treaty. And I was getting really into it, and I realized this is like a particular interest of mine.
Yeah, you realized that your buddies all around you weren't like, whoa, yeah. IMF treaties.
Exactly.
So, I mean, how have you been following the impeachment hearings? Live coverage in what must be the middle of the night in Macedonia, or recaps in the morning? What have you been doing?
It's been a little bit hard, to be honest, especially because it's been, you know, almost every day for those 2 weeks. And I do technically have a job here that I'm supposed to be doing. So a couple of them I've caught live. A couple of them I've had to go back and listen to later. It's been a kind of interesting evening activity where I set my computer up and I stream it. And then I try to get a little bit of work done while I'm listening. So multitasking, I guess, is the answer.
What has it been like hearing the very intricate details of the stories being shared by people who work in the Foreign Service right now, or in a couple of cases, worked in the Foreign Service until recently?
Yes, it's been very interesting for a multitude of reasons. The first being, it's just been like so enlightening to hear them talking just a little bit about their daily activities. Like, and then I wrote this down in the notes after the meeting, and then I set up a call with somebody. And it's very interesting to try to picture what would you do if you were like in a similar situation. And then also just because listening to them describe how they view their role, how they view their work has been, I think, really inspiring for me.
So is there a detail from someone's testimony that really jumped out to you as someone imagining a life like this for yourself, either as a disheartening picture of something going very wrong or an inspiring kind of like, heck yeah, type moment?
Yeah. So the like particular moment that stuck with me the most, I think is because it was actually a little bit like cheesy, but when Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was asked if he would call himself a never Trumper, and he said he would call himself never partisan, I like chuckled a little bit. But that's a moment that's really stuck with me, as I think emblematic of how people working in the National Security Council and the Foreign Service really do view their work. And a lot of the others testifying, Holmes and Fiona Hill especially, really, I think, wove that throughout the entirety of their testimony.
Yeah, Fiona Hill saying, you know, that she'd served under three presidents, Democrat and Republican, and that that was a point of great pride for her. I am curious why that is so inspiring to you, the idea of never partisan.
To me, I think it's very inspiring, just because the goal that I see for myself and wanting to work in the Foreign Service is to help provide the best information possible to my superiors, to help create the best understanding possible, and to help pursue the best path possible. And I think in order to do that, you kind of have to be very self-aware about what biases you're operating off of, what impulses you might already have, and what political alliances you feel. Because I think, to be honest, all of us have our own political opinions, but I think that it's important when you're working in the Foreign Service to be able to be objective about what the situation is and about what your position relative to it does to color your opinion.
So the best understanding in this worldview, best understanding leads to best path forward. And therefore, if you're just giving the best, most complete understanding you can, you are contributing to a good foreign policy, regardless of partisan politics. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that sums it up very nicely.
So, I mean, I am curious, though, at what point in your sort of journey so far did you realize that being nonpartisan would be part of the work?
When I was first thinking that I wanted to try to make it into the Foreign Service one day, I was doing some reading, and one of the books that I read was called The Pinochet Files. And if anybody knows a little bit, there's a long history of controversy over the United States' role in the way that Augusto Pinochet came to power in Chile. And this book details that from a diplomatic perspective. And the whole book was like very, it made me feel very passionate. I was like, I can't believe the role that we took. I can't believe this is how it turned out. And at the end of the book, I thought to myself, oh, I would hate to have the job of the person in the embassy that's doing the daily work and sending all of the information about the situation. And then the policy that's coming out of it is not what they're recommending. And then I thought about it a little more and a little more, and I realized that that person really has the most important job possible of saying the truth as they understand it the best that they can and giving the best advice that they can. And that's all you can really do.
I'm going to jump in and just say we had just a moment of funky connection. And I want to remind our listeners that Mia is joining us from Macedonia, and she's joining us by Skype because that's far away. So yeah. Thanks for.
Yes. Yeah. Apologies.
No, no. So then, Mia, what do you think will be the biggest challenges of being in the Foreign Service if your career goes forward as you envision it? Has there been anything in the impeachment hearings that has made you go, huh, that's going to be a challenge?
I think that one of the things that I've been thinking about lately, between these impeachment hearings and then also my work in the Peace Corps, is just getting more comfortable with kind of the bureaucracy of working in an institution like the State Department. And that's not like a surprising thing to me, but, you know, each situation you kind of have to navigate differently. Like there was some talk in the impeachment hearings about not knowing if, I forget who it was they were referring to, but not knowing if he was the right person to move forward because it was becoming a more and more politically controversial issue. Just navigating those sorts of things. You can't really predict them until they come up, but you want to be able to do your best in so many different situations.
Well, and some of the things you hear about are like, in this phone call on this date, these are the people who were present. This is what I said. This is what they said. Just the, you know, I think it was Sondland who was saying, it's hard to remember a specific conversation, even though it now sounds so important because I speak with foreign leaders every day. That's my job. Just the, what single conversation on what on any given day is are you going to end up needing to remember in line by line detail?
Yeah, it's a lot to think on. Maybe I need to start like a journaling habit.
Yeah, so that you aren't someday saying I'm not a note taker, never have been.
Exactly.
In so many of the personal backstories, there is like an inciting incident, if I could put it that way, that explains this particular person's commitment to the role of the U.S. in global issues, sometimes going back generations. For Sondland, you've got parents fleeing Europe during the Holocaust. For Fiona Hill, you've got this complicated story about coming from a family of miners who served in World Wars I and II, having a father who wanted to come here but couldn't, making her arrival here the fulfillment of his hope for her. Have you ever pictured yourself on the witness stand telling your own family story? Like, sort of imagining, like, what will, like, I know this is not like a dream scenario to be on a witness stand. However, have you imagined what your speech would be?
But yeah, so not a dream. But I do kind of think that for me, it would come back to, you know, living in Kansas as a small child. I think all small children don't really think about politics. But for me, I just felt like in the center of everything, I was removed from everything. And when I started to become more politically conscious, that started to really register with me. And my reaction to that was I wanted to kind of put myself into the middle of it to understand better and to see more of the world and of how our own country operates.
Mia Richardson is with us from the Peace Corps in Macedonia. We'll be right back with another aspiring diplomat story. What have the impeachment hearings taught him or made him wonder about a life in foreign service? Call 816-235-2888 if you've spent the last 2 weeks suddenly fascinated by the lives of ambassadors and foreign service officers. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we've been speaking with Mia Richardson, a KCK native who's in the Peace Corps. She wants to join the Foreign Service someday, and she's been taking the impeachment hearings in from her post in Macedonia. She's feeling more inspired than ever. We'll get back to her soon, but I'm joined now by a junior at William Jewell College in Liberty. He also hopes to pursue a career in this field, and you can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. Jack Still, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. What are you studying at Jewell?
I'm studying economics and political science.
How long have you been thinking about the Foreign Service as a possible career path?
So, to be honest, I'm not as far along in the process as it sounds like Mia is, but kind of the short story is during one of my first political science classes last year, actually, I had one of my professors approach me during a meeting in his office hours, and he kind of introduced this idea to me. He said, have you considered the Foreign Service? And I had not before. And so kind of since then, I've still been weighing my options, and I there's some things I need to figure out, but it's certainly since then I've done some research and I've thought about it, and it's certainly something that I would be interested in pursuing.
So in your thinking and your researching, what has appealed to you?
I think what's appealed to me most is just an opportunity to serve in the Foreign Service, just representing, you know, the interests of your country abroad, and doing what you perceive to be furthering the interest of the country.
Do you still find it as appealing as you did 2 weeks ago? I mean, 2 weeks into these impeachment hearings, as you watch people at the top of their careers as diplomats and ambassadors taking the witness stand, what are your thoughts?
So, yeah, that's a great question. I certainly do still find it as appealing, however, with a lot more uncertainty than before. And really, these 2 weeks have obviously accentuated that, but really since 2016, just I think this sort of the Foreign Service field has become sort of rattled with this uncertainty just because of all the changes it's gone through.
I asked Mia about moments that jumped out to her. Has a moment jumped out to you?
I wouldn't say. I think there are a number of moments that I think this whole process is jumping out to me. So I don't know if I could identify any specific moments, but really what jumps out to me the most is just how far that this administration is willing to go and putting its own interest over the interest of the country and over the Foreign Service and the sanctity and the importance of it.
When you say the sanctity and importance of it, how would you explain what that is?
Well, I think on the drive up, the way I was kind of thinking about articulating this was just that I think what we've seen is the Foreign Service has almost been, it's been transformed into a business. I think from the time President Trump took office and appointed Rex Tillerson, who obviously is no longer Secretary of State, but if you sort of read and listen to what these career foreign service officers have said, it's been transformed into sort of a facet of a way to advance his own interest. And he's not concerned with being informed about the issues that matter. He's interested in pursuing his own personal, ostensibly his own what's ostensibly foreign policy goes, but are actually his own personal interests.
So that's your read on like the substance of the impeachment hearings. I am curious what your understanding is of what the Foreign Service should be, if not a business.
Well, it should be sort of going back to what I said at the beginning. It should be it's how the United States and its interests are represented abroad. And really, that's I think the best way to put it. That's what it's responsible for, and that's what it should do. These Foreign Service officers obviously have their own personal political viewpoints, but it's their role to inform elected officials in the United States on foreign policy, so that at the end of the day, they can make the decisions, and then it's the duty of the Foreign Service officers to represent those decisions abroad.
Have their testimonies sort of solidified that viewpoint for you? 'Cause I am curious about it because in the opening statements, they often give kind of like their mission statements of their work.
Right. I think absolutely. I think it's solidified that view. But I also think it's called into question, you know, how far we've moved from that. I think just almost before our eyes, without us even realizing it, you know, 3 years later, we're in a point where we're questioning, you know, if the State Department will ever be the same moving forward.
So, and that has you questioning what you want to do.
Certainly. I think because if my objective in pursuing a career in this field or in any field, but especially in this field, is to, you know, make my country better. And in the Foreign Service, that's by representing your country abroad and forming policy decisions. But if we're moving in this direction and what's actually being reflected in this impeachment trial is that it's no longer going to be allowed to do that, then maybe a career in the Foreign Service isn't the way to do, it's not the way to do or to complete your objective.
Mia, jump back in here.
Yeah, so I definitely get that perspective and I feel like I've wrestled with some of the same things. But I feel like for me, you know, if I don't pursue this career, the only other options are other people continue to, or literally no one does. So for me, it hasn't changed my career goals, just given me a lot to think about.
Let's start talking with our listeners. We've got a call from Leslie at Mission Hills. She's called 816-235-2888. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Good morning to the guests. It's just terrific hearing their interest. I come from a family of Foreign Service. My father served almost 5 decades in the State Department. He didn't get in for hugely ulterior motives other than to get out of World War II active duty in the Army. That quickly transformed as he became deeply devoted to the work, and I won't list his career service, but there were a couple points that both have made, and I wanted to just talk a little bit about that. One important point to note is the interest of the country abroad is clearly a primary role of Foreign Service officers, but it comes with two-way traffic to also help us as Americans, and that is across a breadth of industry and politics and so on, to understand how we are viewed overseas. So it's not just that we represent our interests overseas, but how we are perceived overseas, how the relationships can benefit then the decisions we make at home. And it isn't, it has to be tied back to policy. So it's a little more nuanced than, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the young gentleman's first name when he got on because I was still on hold. But
a junior in college, so he's got lots of time on his left on his journey.
It's great. Well, and my father also served as a diplomatic posting to a U.S. University to help students see that there was a potential career. We have about 13 usually called diplomats in residence at universities that help people do that when they also spend the year teaching. The other point that Mia made earlier was her concern about navigating bureaucracy. And one of the things I want listeners to think about is unmentioned often in all of this is the funding mess that we inhibit the ability of many agencies, but including the State Department, to actually have enough money to carry out policy. And so we see that hampered. So it's not just that we've created a one-way ticket out for a lot of people who can't stand the environment. It's also politically, but it's also that they are underfunded to carry out the missions. And this is really problematic. And it becomes more problematic when, you know, this was actually Department of Defense funding was then siphoned off of key programs that we were going to see benefit in Missouri, for example, to fund the wall, which became a purely political outcome. So those are some of the issues, I think, that also help feed the nervousness of on the part of bureaucrats and, in this case, Foreign Service. The last thing I wanted to mention. Go ahead, Gina.
Oh, well, I wanted to kind of get into your personal experience just a little bit as someone with your own particular kind of window into the lives of people in the Foreign Service, having grown up as the child of one. And I think that our two young guests, who knows whether they will someday want to have families, but what is it like for a family to be part of the Foreign Service?
Well, it's that would take an entire show.
Highlights or lowlights, whatever you choose.
I would say that it's changed a lot. We served in Europe and also in Africa when I was a child. And there are a lot of problems moving around frequently. I mean, this is not a conversation that anybody growing up in the armed services won't recognize, for kids who are, you know, moved every couple of years or 3 years. And, in my instance, we were often in places where we didn't have an American school. So we would be in French school or in, Belgian school or, you know, grappling with different languages. So, net outcome, if you can muster it and make do, you come out with a broader education than you would ever get in the United States. And I do have facility with some other languages. But I would say, too, that for some people, like I had a sibling who really struggled and never made back up and had a very, you know, uneven education. So that's just one aspect of it, just a tiny aspect of it.
Well, thanks, Leslie.
And yes.
Thank you so much.
And the last
Okay, just make the point quickly, though. I'm sorry to push you along, but
Michael Lewis wrote a book. He wrote Moneyball. He's written many books, but read Fifth Risk because it gets at these very questions about what bureaucrats and bureaucracy actually does for government. Very worthwhile.
Okay. Thank you so much, Leslie.
Thank you.
Mia, did Leslie's call get you thinking about anything, anything you want to respond to in her comments?
I would just want to say thank you to her for sharing, because I actually am like planning to have a family someday and working in the Foreign Service. And I love to hear every possible perspective on that, because I can only imagine like what a crazy life it is. But other than that, I really can respect the budgetary problems that she's talking about, and those sorts of difficulties.
What about you, Jack?
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate her coming on and sharing that. And I think she added a very valuable point to the conversation with regards to what she opened up with. You know, it's not just about representing our interests abroad, but it's also about, you know, kind of maintaining the security and the well-being of who's here, you know, our own citizens. And I think that's great insight. And it was especially nice to hear a perspective of the child of a Foreign Service officer who's lived through it and who's witnessed what a career in this field is like. So
let's hear from another one of our callers. We've got Erica in Kansas City, Missouri with us now. Hi, Erica.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I just want to make a quick comment because I'm a super proud mentor of this young man, but Eric Boone, who attended Howard University, just got the 2020 Thomas Pickering Fellowship. He's always wanted to work in Foreign Service. He's already taught overseas. And being a graduate of Howard University, as he is too, I just want to talk about the need for diversity in Foreign Service and make sure that we're pushing children from diverse backgrounds in that way, because the world looks like everybody. So it's critical that anybody representing America looks like everybody as well.
Yeah, I want to hear more about you and this young man. The young man you're referencing is actually someone we spoke to getting ready for this show, and he was mm-hmm. just not available this morning, but does have a very right. compelling story that maybe you could share through your own lens. First of all, when you say you were his mentor, can you explain that?
So Eric was actually a part of Generation Rap, which is a teen talk show on 103.3. I think it started in 1988. So that's where I first met him. He was a host. After he left Kansas City, he went on to Howard University. He was really active in the School of Communications at Howard University, taught in France. I believe he also taught in England. He's volunteered overseas. He's just done quite a bit. But somewhere around, I think, his freshman years when he told me he was really looking into the Foreign Service, and was just really intrigued with that being his manner of service to the world. He's a volunteer. He teaches. So that's just kind of what his spirit is. And I just thought it was great that he wanted to have his career overseas and really just representing America and making sure that, you know, that we're well-informed that we are good citizens in the world.
When you say that, you know, diversity is important in the Foreign Service because America or the world looks like all of us. Can you talk about what that means to you personally?
Ooh, what does that mean to me personally?
Yes.
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think having traveled overseas, it's interesting to see how we're perceived, how Americans are perceived overall. I am also an African-American woman. So frequently, to be honest, the touch point tends to be entertainment for a lot of countries in terms of African-Americans. So they don't really encounter us one-on-one. So from that perspective, personally, it's important to me that the world see all of us in different ways. But I also think it's critical, too, in terms of how America is viewed, especially given the current political climate. We're not always portrayed in the best light. And so I think it's important that the world also know that we're a very diverse country as well.
Well, Erica.
And it's good for us overall. Sorry?
No, I just wanted to thank you for that call and to thank you for telling us about another Kansas Cityan who is pursuing this path.
Thank you.
So, Mia, what are your thoughts about this as an American who has been living abroad for, you said you're halfway through your service in the Peace Corps in Macedonia?
Yes. Yeah, I think that she raises a very good point. a woman of color, mixed race. My experience in the Peace Corps has been a little bit different at times than some of my peers. And I want to take a step aside and say, like, a major congratulations to, I don't think I caught his name,
Eric.
But for getting the Pickering Fellowship, Eric, yes, congratulations on the Pickering, because that's a huge deal. When I am applying for grad schools, I'm planning to apply for the Charles B. Rangel Fellowship, which is a very similar setup that aims to increase the number of minority members of the Foreign Service. Yeah, so thank you for sharing that perspective.
Can you get back to when you said that, as you said that as a person of mixed race in the Foreign Service or in the Peace Corps, your experience had been different from some of your peers?
Yes. Yeah. So a lot of my experience, at least, is that a lot of times people expect Americans to be white. And sometimes you can explain to them, like, no, I am American. But when you're mixed race, I think that there's another element to it, because I've had this conversation many times, explaining I'm a quarter Black, a quarter Hispanic, and half white. And usually people choose one of those words that they recognize. And they're like, yes, okay, got it. So it's a challenge in communication.
It's interesting, too, that I would imagine in that scenario that you would be in a unique position to see how people's behavior changes based on which of those words they're latching onto.
Yeah, a little bit. So far, my experience has been very positive. I know that's not the case for all volunteers of color by any means, so I don't mean to speak for anybody else. But my particular host family, host community, has been very welcoming. I get asked if I'm Turkish a lot, which, just for the record, I'm not Turkish. But people are definitely curious about my background.
Macedonia's own history and location might have something to do with
Yeah.
that. I'm curious, though, how you expect or imagine that your race might affect your experience in the Foreign Service if you do end up going that route.
Yes. So I think that, as far as I've given it thought so far, it's a little bit hard at this point without a more concrete picture of, like, what the daily workings will be like. But so far, my plan is just to try to find mentors who can help me navigate the experience, who have gone through it before, and then also to remember myself that I have a little bit of a unique perspective. And to keep that in mind, that there's a benefit to that. And then also sometimes to recognize that if I'm coming from a different place than some of my peers, there's a challenge to that, to communicating my own perspective effectively.
Do you see that as part of your mission as you think about this kind of work?
A little bit. Like I talked about earlier, feeling very removed from politics in my younger years and then coming into it, I think it's very important for me to kind of represent, because when I was coming into political consciousness and looking into this, you know, there weren't a lot of role models that were, like, readily available for me to latch on to. And so, especially for my specific community, being from Wyandotte County, I just think it would be amazing to kind of provide a connection there that anybody else who's interested in this at a young age could latch on to.
Jack, we do not know how long these hearings will go on or what else will come to light. What are you hoping to hear, wanting to know as an aspiring future member of the Foreign Service? Like, what are you hoping to learn?
I would say, more than anything, just to learn that at the end of the day, you know, that the Foreign Service that we know and that we've kind of grown to know throughout the years is still within reach. That the damage that has been caused, while it's not just, I guess, that this damage is not irreparable, that we can sort of restore, you know, what the Foreign Service is and the great things that it's done for this country, and hopefully it can continue to do so.
Jack Still, good luck in your final stretch at William Jewell.
Thank you.
And Mia Richardson, it has been a real pleasure hearing your take. Thanks for joining us from Northern Macedonia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mia is a KCK native, and she's in Macedonia for the Peace Corps. When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll have something entirely different. How your bike can become your traveling companion. Don't go away. Kim Horgan has been living my dream life. She's been traveling by train across the country, stopping to go on epic bike rides and documenting the whole experience, the good and the bad, in photographs that she shares online. She's back home in Kansas City, and we're going to hear about her journey. Kim Horgan, welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've been Instagramming your bike travels for a long time, but your most recent adventure was sponsored by Amtrak. Tell me about that. What was your vision for the trip, and how did it all come about?
Well, earlier in the year, I think it was around January, Amtrak ran a contest on Instagram, and I follow them. So they were asking for regular people to take a trip and then to kind of report back on social media about the trip.
And this was called something like, what was the name of the contest again?
It was the Amtrak Take Me There contest. Yeah. So you become an Amtrak ambassador for your journey.
I think I want to start with the bikes and then talk about trains. You've gotten kind of a following, and what you're known for is traveling long distances alone on a bicycle. And you photograph the bike in these settings. So it's not so much typically like the selfie, it's the bike portrait.
Yes.
But I guess like the solo travel by bike, that's something that I've known a lot of men to do, and I never really thought about it until hearing your story. I have not known many women to do that.
Well, yeah, and I haven't been doing really long trips yet, which is something I'd like to work into, but just going out on the trail and being out there by myself for a few days is something that I enjoy. I can't even describe how much I enjoy just the peace of it, the ability to kind of clear your head. It kind of relieves you of all the stress. And then I think a nice thing of it is just that you're at your own pace. So you're not having to, you know, check with someone else about stopping and, you know, the schedule is your own. I like to stop and take a lot of pictures, which a lot of people don't like to do. So
how did you get started as this sort of bicycling Instagrammer?
You know, I was thinking about that the other day. A couple years ago, I got back into cycling when I was getting a divorce, and I just started to spend more time out on my bike. And I guess I just, you know, it was when Instagram was new. I didn't know what to post on Instagram. I think the only thing I posted really was my cat and some things. So I just started taking a picture of my bike wherever I was, just kind of to say this is, you know, the trip I'm on or the ride, because it was nice. And the bike
was your companion.
Yeah. So the bike had become kind of this thing where we were, you know, adventure partners, if that makes sense.
No, I love that.
So I think part of it was just not so much showing the bike, you know, for what it was, but it was just showing the story of where the bike took me.
What inspired you to document it all with photography? Because you could have just gone on the adventure, I guess, that you've kind of answered that in some way. Like, this is your, like, if you had been on the trip with a spouse, you might have taken a picture of that person mm-hmm. against the landscape, and the bike was now your travel partner.
Yeah, I kind of thought, I mean, when you're on a bike, you see things that you wouldn't normally see. So I feel like the bike is kind of the key to exploring things that you wouldn't really normally see. So whereas if I'm on a bike ride and I just take a random turn or go down an alley, or if I'm on a trail, I just turn and see where that road goes. So the bike becomes more than just transportation. It's kind of your key to opening up, you know, places that you would never see. I think bikes do that, though. You take a different path than if you were in a car, you wouldn't really see any of this.
And a different pace.
Yeah, it's definitely, for me especially, slower. I've never really been about going fast or trying to get there in a certain amount of time. I prefer to just see everything that's on the way.
You don't just post your bicycling triumphs. You share the mess ups. You share the frustrations. And just so our listeners can get a feel for that, tell me one of your favorite not so glorious moments that made it into your feed.
Well, there was a time when I was riding the Katy Trail, and I was out in a pretty secluded spot, and I had found an old grain silo that was abandoned, and I have a thing for abandoned places anyway, so I thought I would go out into this field in the silo and look around. I propped my bike up on the wall of the silo, and it was pretty windy, and my bike blew into the silo, which was not full of grain, but it was, you know, an empty, abandoned spot. There's the bike, so I jumped in after it. And then once I got down there, I realized that I had no cell service and really maybe no way to get back out because it was straight concrete walls.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the inside of a grain silo.
Well, this one was luckily not as deep in that area. But
luckily.
Yes, because I started thinking about how long I might be there before someone happened to come by. But luckily, I piled some things up and kind of made a ladder and got myself out. But things like that seemed to happen to me a lot. You know, bee stings that caused me to crash. And just, it's not always so perfect. But I like to share that with people because I think they can relate more to, possibly, maybe that's why they relate to my feed, because I'm not the fastest and I don't have the nicest, you know, any bike or anything else. It's just that
Things aren't stopping
you. Yeah. No, I'm just the mediocre person. I'm the person that's doing rides that anyone can do. I'm taking trips, you know, that people can actually do. They're not huge, epic trips. I just try to make the smaller trips more fun.
You do have quite a following, and I understand that particularly a lot of women have reached out to you about wanting to feel comfortable traveling alone, but that there's some intimidation that exists out there.
Yeah, that's true. I do ride by myself almost all the time, and sometimes you can feel a little bit threatened or unsafe. I've had women send me messages saying that I've inspired them to get out there on their own and to explore, to take bike rides or even hikes, you know, by themselves. So that, I think that was one of the things that meant the most to me.
How do you think about that sense of, you know, that there are threats out there, that they're to some degree real, but that it's worth it to you to go out there anyway? How do you sort of frame that in your own mind?
I'm not going to let somebody stop me from doing what I want to do. I know it's not always, you know, 100% safe to be by yourself, but I don't think that we should let that stop us from doing whatever we want. I think the key is to try to be safe and be aware, you know, and just make good decisions other than the grain silo, but other good decisions.
So this recent trip on Amtrak, what was it like?
The Amtrak trip was absolutely wonderful, really. I've always wanted to take a long distance overnight train trip. And so when I applied for that, I think it was in January, they had thousands of people apply. They didn't even announce the winner, you know, for months because they had so many applications. And then I got an email from them in, I think it was April, saying that they'd chosen me to go on the trip. And I seriously couldn't believe it. But so at that point, we started planning where I would go and, you know, what the trip would look like.
Where did you go?
Well, I went from Kansas City to Chicago and then Chicago to Harpers Ferry, West Virginia.
So can you, first of all, tell me a favorite story or maybe a favorite couple of stories from the adventure that just really stick with you as like, man, that was cool.
Oh, from the Amtrak?
Yeah.
Honestly, everything about it to me was cool. This was the first time I had a sleeper car on a train. So I expected, you know, this, I don't know, I think I expected a big room in my mind, but it was very small.
Is it still the chair that sort of slides into bed, yes, into horizontal position?
It is. There are two chairs facing each other. And then in the evening, they come around and make the chair into your bed. So I wasn't quite prepared for that. It was fun, though. And I think one of the best things about the train was just that you wake up in the morning and you look out the window on the train and you're somewhere else. The sun's coming up. All the scenery is flying by and you absolutely have no idea what, you know, you don't even know what state you're in.
Trains seem to actually be kind of re-entering the conversation about transit in this country after a pretty long period of kind of being overlooked or forgotten. Did you have, other than the bed thing, any realizations about train travel and what that's like as a result of this experience?
Yeah, I think one of the things that people like about train travel, based on the people that I talked to on the train, also comments that people, you know, feedback people gave me after the trip, was that the pace of train travel is it's slow. There's delays, but there's something about it that appeals to people and that it's almost like going back in time. When you're on the train, a lot of the times you don't have cell service and you are going, you know, often pretty slow. You have to stop, let other trains go by. But a lot of people just take a book and they take games on the train, and you'll walk past and see people playing cards. So it's just a different feel to it that I think appeals to people now because we're all so busy.
Yeah, and there's also trains. Can you talk about where they stop within towns and sort of where they pass through within towns? Because it's not the same places as the highways. And I feel like that even if you've been on a trip somewhere by car, you might really see that same journey very differently by train.
Yeah, what I noticed on the train, so from the Chicago to Harper's Ferry, you see kind of almost the back door in a sense. Like when the train stops in small towns, you're seeing their main street. And you see kind of the backsides of school buildings and community centers, and you see people going about their lives sitting on porches. It's a really interesting view. And the nice thing is you can just sit there and watch it go by.
You mentioned talking to other people traveling by train. That's the thing. I mean, just a couple of years ago, I took a train from Kansas City to St. Louis and back. And what really left me sort of intrigued about that experience was that you could tell that this kind of commute factored into people's lives in some way. I was very interested that it wasn't just tourists on the train. There were people for whom the train was like part of life. And I guess I hadn't realized what a significant population there was still out riding trains. What did you get any sense of who was riding the train and why, other than you?
Yeah, I think the train was filled with quite a variety of people. The interesting thing about the train is when you're on certain routes, they seat you for dinner with strangers in the dining car. So you actually get to hear a lot of stories of where other people are going and how they feel about the train. So the people that I've met, most of them are big train fans, though. They're taking the train because they'd rather go slow and they don't want to fly. They kind of like the pace. They like the whole – they're just – it's like a group of train fans, I guess you would say. So I think some definitely retired. I met a lot of retired couples that are taking the train across the entire country, stopping at different, you know, along the way. They might stop for a few days in Chicago and then take it all the way, like from New York to LA. Met a couple.
Seriously,
that.
I love this. I'm writing this down for when I'm retired.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think I've seen a little bit of everyone on the train, but the thing is, everybody seems to be, in my experience, a little bit more relaxed. I mean, no one's in a hurry. People aren't pushing and shoving. Everybody knows it's going to take you forever to get there.
And you took your bike.
I took my bike. That was the first time I'd taken my bike somewhere that far. And that was, it was nice. It was a kind of a learning experience for me to try to navigate the train station and layovers in Chicago, dragging my bike and luggage through the station. But it worked out fine. It actually was not that difficult at all.
Now that you're home, how long before your next adventure? Will you be biking around town or heading off again?
You know, that's kind of hard. And it's funny you said that. I've been gone almost since March. I've had a trip every few weeks somewhere, even if it's just, you know, like a weekend to the Flint Hills, or went to Utah this summer, and I've had things planned. And then my last thing I had planned was the Katy Trail. So now I was at a point where I was starting to plan for next year. So I just booked a cabin for Arkansas for next year. So I'm just starting to plan for the next trips.
What tips do you have before we go for people who do want to get more into traveling and seeing the landscape on either on a bicycle or by train?
I think what stops a lot of people is that they might think they have to have a lot of time or a big budget. And I don't really have either. I just basically try to work in on any time I have off work, I try to make it into some kind of a weekend getaway. So it doesn't have to be like a, you know, a long distance, a huge trip, and it doesn't have to be expensive. So I think the best thing I would say is research, because there's something interesting pretty much everywhere. So if you have, you know, a long weekend, then maybe you want to go to, you know, Bentonville, or go down to go to Chicago for the weekend and take the train just for a quick overnight. So I think my advice would just be to, you know, to get out there and do it and don't put it off.
Kim Horgan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Kim Horgan spoke to us after returning from a big trip that she took as a winner of a contest put on by Amtrak. You can see what she and her bike are up to on Instagram if you want to follow along on their adventures together. She's Kim_Horgan, H-O-R-G-A-N. We'll link to it with the audio from today's show. It'll be online at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. That's also where you can get last Friday's food show, which had lots of good info if you're making duck this Thanksgiving. Apparently, people do that. Also, tips for anyone wanting to have someone else make the turkey, places in Kansas City where you can get a turkey fried or smoked, lots of options, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, hometown girl Heidi Gardner stops by the studio before turning on the plaza lights for the holidays. You can follow us on Twitter and talk to us there. We're at KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Mackenzie Martin and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.